Wait, we need to be careful, Austin said, pulling Raven to a stop. She did the same, dismounting and looping the reins over a side mirror on a big Chevy truck. Together, the two of them approached the Humvee, Amanda on the left and Austin on the right. Both of them had their guns drawn, ready to shoot if a threat appeared. There's a body, Amanda called out. I've got one on the passenger side, too, Austin replied. Back seat, Amanda called out. Austin approached the rear of the vehicle, his gun still out as he reached for the handle and pulled it open. A man dressed all in black slumped to the side, nearly hitting the pavement. Austin caught his shoulder, holding him up while he slid his gun to his back. He's alive, he called out. Amanda raced around the vehicle, hooking her arms under the man's unconscious body and gently pulling him out while Austin grabbed his legs. They laid him on the pavement, while Amanda quickly took his vitals and then began assessing his injuries. He's in bad shape, she said, defeated. What's this uniform they're all wearing? Austin asked, moving the man's black jacket to the side. I don't know. There's no name or patch indicating what branch they're with. Austin ran his eyes along the man's clothing, shaking his head. Nothing. He's not going to make it, she whispered, her fingers moving back to take the pulse at his neck. What do you think happened? Austin asked, noticing a lack of obvious injuries. Brain trauma is my guess, she said, pointing to the blood trickling out of his ear. Austin looked at the crashed vehicle. They must have been going pretty fast to kill all three of them on impact. These rigs are meant to withstand a lot. Let's check the Humvee. Maybe we'll find out where they were going, she said, getting to her feet. The front seats were ignored. The blood and gore from the two occupants slamming into the windshield wasn't something either of them were interested in touching. Bloodborne diseases were still a concern. There are boxes back here, Austin called out with excitement. Amanda hoped it would be a case of MREs and water, truth be told. She rushed to the back and pulled open one of the flaps on the first medium-sized cardboard box. It was full of flyers. She pulled one out as Austin did the same. As she read the banner, her blood ran cold. True Patriot, she breathed out. What the hell is this crap? Austin growled, flipping through a sheaf of the flyers with a look of sheer disgust on his face. He tossed the flyers to the ground and started digging deeper into the box. This is bad, Amanda said, her brain reeling as she read the message of hate and violence detailed on a brochure she'd picked up from the side of the box. It was calling for action from those who considered themselves to be patriots. It asked people to join the crusade against those who had torn the country apart, promising a salvation of sorts for those who helped clean the earth. I don't understand, Austin muttered, pulling out another flyer and reading the same smaller print again, as if he'd read it wrong the first time. They're telling people to kill people. This is where the religious crap is coming from. This is someone trying to destroy the country from the inside out, she realized. We'll never make it through this if the entire population of the United States is fighting each other, Austin said, his lip curled in disgust. Amanda continued reading the message, an icy shiver of dread snaking down her back, making her physically shudder. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. What? Austin asked, looking up to meet her eyes. Is it too crazy to believe someone is spreading this filth because they want to be seen as the savior of sorts? By pitting people against one another and creating an enemy that has to be eliminated, the people distributing this are creating a loyal following. Austin looked thoughtful for a moment. The bushy beard growing in from a lack of shaving made him look even more scholarly, but it didn't bring a smile to her face now, like it sometimes did. It's a tool Hitler used, and many dictators before him, he said. Again, look at the Middle East, he murmured, as if he were talking more to himself than her. Who? Who would do this? Do you think the people behind this flyer are also behind the EMP? She asked. She'd said it without thinking, but he was quick to agree, nodding so easily that it shocked her. I do. Why? She demanded. He pointed to the box. How would anyone print these flyers post-EMP? Her mouth dropped open, then shut. Oh. Things are going to get a lot worse. I'm sure there are more guys just like this, traveling around and handing out flyers inciting violence. Look at this, he said, reaching forward to grab another box, then pulling a bottle of water from a case tucked inside. Her eyes widened. At least she had been partially right. She pulled at the corner of another box in front of her, yanking the flaps back to find MREs and tiny bags of nuts like the kind an airline would hand out. There was the True Patriot logo on every package and every bottle of water. She started shaking her head. This isn't the usual military-type rations, she muttered, ripping open another box and finding small personal packs of shampoo, wet wipes, toothbrushes, and toothpaste. There were hundreds of the little packs. What do you think all this is? He asked, surveying the back end of the rig filled with boxes. She took a deep breath, wishing she could be wrong. It looks like humanitarian aid packs. She swallowed. If she was right, that meant that people in charge were using the guise of humanitarian aid and gifts to back up a message of hatred, bribing people to turn against men and women who might as well have been their neighbors. What if they're handing these out with the flyers? Austin asked, reading her fear. They're buttering people up, pretending to be helping while they're recruiting, he said, tossing one of the personal packs to the back. This is bad, which is why I need to get my kid. We're not far from my brother's property. We're probably a day's ride away if we get moving now. Austin, we need to load up as much of this as we can. This is too good to leave behind, she said, already calculating the weight. He put his hands on his hips, staring at her and shaking his head. I already know what you're going to say, and the answer's no. Austin, we aren't going to be any help if we're dead. We need the food and water, she insisted. We take enough for a few days, he said flatly. I don't want to walk, and I know you're going to say that our weight and the weight of the goods will be too much for the horses. It'll take too long to walk, though. And honestly, my leg is already sore, he told her. She groaned, wishing she could find a way to argue. She didn't want to leave any of this behind. What if it took longer than planned to get to his brother's house? She felt pulled between taking too much and slowing them down, and not taking enough and moving fast but possibly running out of food and water. She closed her eyes, knowing this was a compromise she had to make. Fine. We use the shoestrings from their boots, tie the water bottles together, and wear them around our necks, and we can hang a few more off the back of the saddles. The saddlebags will hold a few MREs. I guess washing my hair isn't a big deal, but I am taking one of those packs for myself, she said firmly. He smiled, his blue eyes dancing. I think that's reasonable. Those little bottles don't weigh much. Take a couple. We could use the plastic bags for something, I'm sure. Maybe trade the toiletries for food. I think we should burn those flyers, she added, feeling defiant. He shrugged, lifted the box out of the back end of the Humvee, and walked a few feet away from the stalled vehicles on the road. He ripped a few of the paper flyers before pulling the lighter out of his pocket and igniting the edges. Amanda came up behind them, both of them staring at the box as the flames slowly grew, engulfing the papers and eventually the box, sending up thick black smoke. Let's get loaded, Austin said after a moment more passed. I want to get out of here. I think we definitely need to stay off the roads. I don't want to know what these guys are like when they're alive and breathing. We'll search the rig for anything else that might be usable, and then we're out of here, he said, walking to the man lying dead on the road and going to work at removing the long laces from his boots. Amanda took the first shoestring and tied it around the top of a water bottle. They worked in silence, looting some gum from one of the men and searching for weapons. "Why don't they have guns?" she asked, finding it strange. "Judging by that leg holster on the front passenger, I'd say they did have guns. Someone got here before us and took them," Austin replied, removing the holster and putting it on his own thigh. She took a second to admire the holster, or rather the leg the holster was attached to. "I like it," she said, grinning. He looked up from where he'd been testing the fit of his gun in the newly attained holster. "You like what?"
"The holster. You look very mercenary, commando-ish," she said, for lack of a better word.
He gave her a strange look. "Thanks, I think. I'm going to see if I can wear the one the other guy has on." He nodded, going back to searching the man's pockets. She grabbed the leather strap with the tips of her fingers, wishing it weren't wet with his blood. For lack of other options, she wiped it against the cloth of the man's pants. Sucking up her discomfort over looting a body, she put the strap on her right thigh, tightening it as far as it would go, and neatly sliding her gun into place. She took a couple of steps then, testing the weight and feel, before going back around the vehicle to help Austin load the horses up. He turned and pointedly looked at her leg, smiling when he saw her new accessory. "What? It'll be a lot easier to grab in a hurry," she said, shrugging a shoulder and feeling a little self-conscious. "You look like Lara Croft," he said with a small laugh. She looked down at her leg. "Works for me. Lara Croft is a badass." They each drank two bottles of water before heading out, wanting to hydrate as much as possible without having to carry extra water. And then they dug into the MREs and stuffed their faces before downing another bottle each. "That should be enough calories and water to keep us going for the rest of the day," Austin commented with a satisfied sigh. She nodded. "I get it. You don't want to stop and eat."
"No, I don't," he said.
With as much as they could carry loaded onto the horses, they set off, heading away from the main roads. It was clear that they were dealing with a lot more than a loss of power. Someone was purposely stirring the pot and creating more drama, which Amanda feared would result in the country imploding from the inside. At the very least, she guessed that was the faceless group's intention. 29. Savannah settled into her makeshift bed alongside a couple of the other revivalists. The ground was hard and a little damp, and her legs were aching after a long day of climbing uphill. She hadn't known it was possible to keep climbing upward for so long. Malachi had assured her they were close to her uncle's, but she worried that he only wanted to make her feel better. She was so exhausted it seemed impossible that they were actually going to reach her uncle's house within the next day or two. Now she closed her eyes, willing her brain to go to sleep. The aches in her body were distracting, drawing her attention to even the smallest discomforts, but she tried to picture her uncle's face and think about the big house she remembered visiting in the past. There were extra rooms and beds. Real beds. She was looking forward to sleeping in a bed, away from bugs and dirt. Thankfully, everyone had been moving a lot faster in the last 2 days. It meant more progress, though it had left her sore. She wasn't alone, though, not in her discomfort or in her fears. The tone of the group had been subdued after losing Jim, Bill, and Tim. She kept seeing their bodies in her mind every time she closed her eyes. Malachi had barely made a sound, only speaking to tell them all that they had to keep pushing on.
They stayed far away from any towns and chose to forage for plants and some of the wild berries they came across. That was one good thing about going uphill into the mountains. There seemed to be a lot more food for them to pick at. Thinking of that, she felt herself begin to drift off and renewed her resolve to fall asleep and stay asleep for as long as she could. When she was awoken some time later, the sky was darker, with only a few stars in the sky that she could see. She'd made her bed under some very tall pine trees, using the needles to keep her off the ground as much as possible. She lay perfectly still, wondering what had awakened her, her eyes open and trying to see through the inky blackness of night. She heard someone moving. "Malachi?" she whispered, wondering if he was taking watch. She knew he hadn't been sleeping much and had been taking extra shifts, choosing to let the others sleep. There was another rustling sound from behind her. She quickly sat up, wondering if it was a bear or some other wild animal. "Malachi, is that you?" she hissed again. Her answer was a big, warm hand being clapped over her mouth, silencing any further questions. Definitely not Malachi. She squirmed, reaching her hands back to claw at her attacker's face. Her actions didn't make a difference, and suddenly she was yanked to her feet and dragged backwards. Savannah kicked and twisted and tried going completely slack, like her dad had taught her, but her dead weight wasn't enough to slow down her kidnapper. She judged it to be a man, his hard, muscular arm around her waist in a vise so tight that she could barely breathe. Combined with a hand over her mouth, somewhat blocking her nose, she felt like she would pass out from a lack of oxygen. "Shh," her captor whispered close to her ear. He continued dragging her across the rocky ground, away from the group. She began stomping her feet, slamming her heels into the ground, trying to wake someone up. Who was on watch? Why weren't they trying to save her? An icy shiver of dread slid down her back. What if her kidnapper had killed Malachi, or whoever was on watch? She began to scream behind the hand with all the strength she could muster, and bit down hard on the fleshy palm, earning her a brief reprieve. "Mal!" she screamed, only to have the hand slap over her mouth again, quieting her scream. "Savannah?" she heard Malachi call out in the distance. Tears had filled her eyes and begun sliding down her cheeks when she saw the shadow of a horse. There was no way Malachi would be able to save her or stop this man from riding away with her, and she couldn't even scream out to let him know where she was or what direction she'd been taken in. With one hand fisted in her hair, the man released her mouth as he climbed into the saddle with one easy, quick move. "Malachi!" she screamed again, taking advantage of the release of her mouth. "Savannah!" Malachi shouted in response as she was pulled up onto the horse in front of the man. The horse was kicked into a fast trot and then a canter, leaving Savannah to hold on for dear life. She could hear Malachi's shouts mixed in with the others in the group as she was carried away. "What do you want?" she choked out.
"I want to talk to your daddy," he said in a cool voice.
"Dad? How do you know who I am, or who my dad is?" she demanded, convinced the man had her confused with someone else.
"I know. I've been following you since Kentucky. Your dad will come and save you, don't worry," he said, laughing suddenly into her ear.
"My dad's alive?" she asked.
"You better hope he's alive," the man replied.
"Why my dad? I don't understand. What do you want?" she cried out, hating that she sounded so weak and whiny.
He didn't answer her for a long time as he navigated the horse back to one of the paved roads the group of revivalists had been working so hard to avoid. Eventually the canter slowed to a trot, and then a walk, and then he finally spoke.
"He has something of mine. I want it back. I expect he's going to be on his way to find you. I beat him to you, so you'll bring him to me. When he gives me what's mine, he can have you back, he replied casually, as if he were talking about a transaction instead of a hostage trade. Savannah tried to imagine what her father could have in his possession. She was elated to have someone telling her he was alive, but this man could be crazy. It didn't make sense that his father would know someone who would kidnap young girls in the middle of the night. I think you have my father and I confused with someone else, she said, hoping to talk some sense into the man. He chuckled. I don't get confused. Your father is Austin Merriman, and he's a journalist. You're his daughter, Savannah. I found your note, Savannah. I know you're going to your uncle's house outside of Denver, which happens to be very convenient for me because that's exactly where I'm headed. If blood could have frozen and left her alive, hers just had. She felt cold, deadly cold, and it had nothing to do with the nighttime temperatures. This man knew who she was. He'd been to their trailer, and he was after her father. The thought terrified her.
Please don't hurt my dad, she whispered.
He laughed again. I don't care if your father lives or dies. I want what's mine. He can hand it over and walk away. Or die. I don't care either way, but I will get it back.
What? What does he have? She shrieked.
You don't need to worry about that. You better say a prayer or chant or whatever it is your friends taught you to do. If your dad doesn't show, you're going to be meeting the big guy in the sky, or whatever you believe, he said in a low growl. He's got some time to come after you, but not forever, especially not when you're being this much of a pain. You should learn to be quiet. She had the sudden urge to vomit.
I'm going to be sick, she muttered.
Don't get it on my leg or my shoe, he replied, without slowing his horse down. With that casual answer, her situation slammed into her. This man wasn't like the crazy people in the cave. He seemed far more dangerous. She could feel the evil rolling off of him in waves. Escaping him would not be easy, but that didn't mean she wouldn't try. She was not a quitter, she reminded herself. The thought of her father being alive and on his way to her buoyed her hopes, too. She had to get away from the man to keep her father safe. She didn't believe him when he said her dad would be able to walk away from this after agreeing to the trade. She wasn't well-versed in bad guys, maybe, but she'd seen enough movies and read enough books. The chances of him letting her and her father walk away after he got whatever it is he wanted seemed very unlikely.
30. Nash hadn't looked forward to hiking back to the mine, but now that he knew exactly where the house was located, he felt convinced he could be back by nightfall. When he'd headed away from the mine originally, he'd set off in the direction opposite Ennis's house, to the campground and beyond it, before really deciding on what direction made most sense. And he'd gotten turned around at least once after that point. The way the crow flew, it should only be a half day's walk, and the maps Ennis had stored in the house pretty much confirmed that. Nash was happy to be getting away from Wendell also, and glad Ennis had agreed to go along for the hike, claiming he needed to stretch his legs after being cooped up in the house for so long. "You're sure you can get that wind turbine to work?" Ennis asked for at least the tenth time. Nash nodded as they walked along a narrow path through the thick pine trees. "Yes, the wind is always blowing around here, at least a little. With the way that turbine is positioned high up on the hill behind your house, we should get a steady breeze."
"It will work like the solar power system?" he asked.
"Yes, but unlike the solar panels that can only run actively during the day and then store power into a battery, the wind turbine will run all night. We'll have power around the clock," Nash replied.
"Enough to run the refrigerator? I think we need to conserve as much propane as we can. If we can switch to electric instead of propane, that'll help, Ennis said.
Nash mulled it over.
Do you really need a refrigerator? I do have a lot of meat in the freezer. We're going to need that if this thing lasts a long time.
Do you hunt? Nash questioned.
Ennis chuckled. Let's say that I've been hunting and I can shoot, but I've never actually gotten anything. I can't say I've ever really wanted to, either. It was so much easier to go to the store to buy the meat I wanted.
Nash imagined that most folks had felt that way before, but things had changed.
We'll need to hunt, but I have zero experience in that department.
We have enough meat in the freezer to last us a while. That, combined with the freeze-dried food in the pantry, should be enough to last us a year. Give us some time to learn to hunt if we need to.
I have a hydroponic system set up, too, but I've never actually bothered to get it up and working, he confessed.
That excited Nash.
Really? I've read about those. I think I could get it going.
Then by all means, go for it. We'll need the fresh veggies. That dehydrated stuff doesn't have the same flavor, he grumbled.
Nash laughed. I think there are a lot of people who would be more than happy to eat the dried stuff if they had it.
Do you have seeds?
I do. I bought a huge supply of heirloom seeds.
Why would you buy them if you weren't going to plant them? Nash asked, the practical side of him unable to keep the question in.
Ennis chuckled. I liked to call myself a prepper. I went to all the shows and bought just about everything I could get my hands on. But I will admit I don't know much about the actual survival part of it. I read a lot, and keeping a supply of heirloom seeds was recommended. I bought more than I could ever possibly need because it seemed like a great deal.
Nash burst into laughter.
And the hydroponics?
The man looked a little embarrassed now.
Another thing I was told I should have.
Nash nodded in understanding, not wanting to look a gift horse in the mouth.
I'm sure we'll figure it out.
I have some books and stuff that should help, Ennis added.
Good. I'm thinking we'll need to grab some extra cables to rig a better pulley system for that door, too. We have to be prepared for people trying to come and take the supplies. I want to be able to raise and lower it, and quite frankly, I don't trust those rocks we've got piled up not to slip.
If you get consistent power running, the electronics might work again, Ennis replied.
Nash looked at him, raising one eyebrow. Do you really want to count on that? I, for one, do not want to get trapped in that house.
Especially not with your buddy. I'm pretty sure he'd turn cannibal and eat me first.
Ennis laughed. He's an odd duck, but harmless.
I'm sure that's what everyone thought about Dahmer, too, he quipped, though he was only half joking.
They walked on in silence after that, weaving in and out of the trees and up the mountain towards the mine.
Is that it?
Ennis asked, pointing up ahead to a gravel road.
Yep.
They picked up the pace, following the road to the mine entrance. There were several pickups in the makeshift parking lot out front. The doors were all open now as well, and there was trash strewn about, signifying the vehicles had already been looted.
What were you doing up here?
Ennis asked.
Some buddies and I were exploring the old mine.
It's what we do.
I'd been scheduled to go to school this fall to get my doctorate in geology. I was spending the summer traveling around, checking out old mines and doing a little spelunking, he replied.
Spell what? Ennis questioned.
Spelunking. We go into caves and basically explore.
Huh. Right. Doesn't sound like a lot of fun to me, I gotta tell you.
It's interesting to see the different layers of the earth. I love it.
I guess I won't be going to school in the fall now, he muttered, still having a hard time accepting that fact.
All that hard work he had put into graduating early, skipping over things like prom and high school football games in order to get ahead in life,
only to be put right back on a level playing field with the rest of the population. "How are we going to see in here?" Ennis asked, coming to a dead stop in front of the mine. Nash pulled out his last glow stick. "This?" "Of course. I have some of those in my stash at home as well. I didn't think to bring any." "It's okay. I always come prepared." Ennis burst into laughter. "I'm the prepper, and I show up unprepared." Nash shrugged, grinning. "This is my area of expertise. You can show me how to hunt, and how to use all those other gadgets you have around the house," Nash told him, patting him on the shoulder, before cracking the glow stick and illuminating the tunnel. "I'll do my best, but I have to admit I ignored all the advice from real preppers. I never took half that stuff out of the packages to learn how to use it. I honestly figured I'd never need it." "Then why do you have it?" Nash asked, moving into the mine. "I guess it made me feel better, safer. I knew I was ready for the apocalypse. It started after 9/11. I realized then how vulnerable we really were. Then when Hurricane Katrina hit and all those people were stranded in New Orleans without food, water, or even the ability to take a shower, it kind of spiraled from there. I started going to prepper conferences and conventions, buying up all the stuff I saw. I didn't want to be one of the helpless," he explained. Nash turned to look at him and smiled. "I'm glad you did all that, man, because you saved my bacon." Ennis chuckled again. "Not like I did all that with you in mind. I assumed my brother and his family would come crawling up to my front door after going without, though I will tell you that. My brother, he thought it was a waste of money to build that house. I don't know where he is now, but I bet you he's wishing he would have listened to me. I think a lot of people wish they would have listened to Doomsday Preppers." They'd walked a little deeper into the mine when Nash spotted a crude steel door. He reached out to try and open it. "What's that?" Ennis asked, standing beside him. Nash shook his head, staring at it. "I don't know. I don't remember seeing this before. I must have walked right past it. Or maybe it was covered up somehow so we wouldn't notice it." "What do you think is in there?" Nash stared for another moment before turning away. Curiosity was eating at him, but they had other priorities to deal with first. "I have no idea. We don't have time to try and get past that lock right now. The leftover cables aren't too much farther. We'll grab them and start walking back," he said. He found the coiled cable lying on the rocky ground right where he remembered. Picking up one of the thick coils of cable, he realized it weighed a lot more than he had initially expected. And when he looked at Ennis, he realized the man was probably not going to be able to carry one of the coils. True to expectation, Ennis reached down and struggled to lift the cable. "These are heavier than they look." Nash nodded. "Grab that spool of wire. I think this will be enough cable. We only need it to run the small pulley near the bottom of the turbine. The rest of it seemed to be in good shape." Ennis grabbed the wire before reaching down and picking up a roll of duct tape. "You can never have too much duct tape," he said with a smile. Nash chuckled as he started walking, the cable weighing him down. It was going to be a long hike back to the house and over rough terrain. He'd taken easier terrain while traveling before, conserving his supplies, which was another reason he'd taken so long to get from the mine to Ennis's house. But it only made sense to go straight there now. His arms, shoulders, and back were going to be aching by the time they got back. "How long have you lived up here?" Nash asked, trying to make conversation and keep his mind off the pain in his shoulder. "I only started living up here full-time about a year ago. Before that, I had an apartment in the city. I still went into Denver on occasion to work, but most of it I could do from here. I wonder, with all that's happened, does this mean I'm retired?" he mused aloud. Nash laughed. "I think we're all retired for the time being." Ennis nodded beside him and caught his eye as they walked, his expression growing more serious.
I'm glad you came along. I know I could have lived in the house for a long time, but I was really going stir-crazy in there, Ennis said. I'm happy I could help. And I'm happy I came along as well. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I guess what they say about needing a community to survive the apocalypse is true, Ennis said quietly. We'll all have to work together. Even Wendell, he added pointedly. He was hoping Wendell would move on soon, though. Nash got the idea Wendell wasn't at all who he said he was, even if Ennis had known him for 20 years. For now, Nash would keep his guard up around the guy. After several hours of walking with short breaks along the way, the house came into view just as the sun began setting. Nash left the cable sitting outside on the front stoop and dropped to his knees to crawl under the door first. He was hoping to have enough cable to take care of the door. For now, though, all he could think about was drinking, eating, and resting his aching body.
You're back! Wendell greeted them from his place, sprawled on the couch with a book in his hands. He was wearing a pair of sweats borrowed from Ennis and a T-shirt. Nash had to fight back the urge to scream at the man for being so lazy. Still, he kept his frustration in check and headed for the kitchen to fill a glass with water, drinking heartily before refilling it and downing the second glass. He could hear Ennis and Wendell talking in the other room, but ignored them and focused on replenishing his body. Tomorrow he would get to work on fixing the broken cable on the turbine and restoring full power to the home. That would be his immediate contribution to their little tribe. He was still waiting to see what Wendell brought to the table.
31. Austin rode ahead of Amanda, driven on by the latest news they'd gotten of the Loveridge Group. They'd come across a small family living in a tiny cabin off the grid. It had taken some convincing, but the family had admitted to seeing the band of revivalists a short time ago. They'd confirmed Savannah was with them, and it had buoyed Austin to know she was alive and well, and within reach, kind of. "Austin, slow down," Amanda called out. "We're close," he shouted back. "Yes, we are, which means we're going to be on them soon, but they could be anywhere. The family said they were sticking to the trees," she argued. "We need to watch for them. They're going to be hiding." Austin ignored her, riding on and knowing he was close. He couldn't stop now. He couldn't wait to wrap his arms around his little girl and hold her tight. More and more, he was furious with himself for ever leaving her in the first place. He should never have met Callum. He should have been at the trailer and waiting for her that night. Even as he heard Amanda call out again behind him, he saw a young woman up ahead. She was bent over, picking something up from the ground. "Hey!" he called out. She shot upright, stared at him for a moment, and then took off running into the trees. The reaction wasn't exactly what he'd been hoping for. "Now you scared her!" Amanda scolded him, riding up alongside him.
"I didn't mean to."
"I told you to slow down. You know they're skittish," she lectured. "That family said they were keeping a low profile, which is good, and you know it. It's not like they'll recognize you on sight." Austin shot her a glare.
"I get it."
"You look scary, with all that facial hair and that wild look in your eye," she continued.
All right, I get it. I'll slow down. But we do need to hurry so we can catch up with her. She has to be part of the revivalist group," he insisted.
Amanda looked after her, as if to question the conclusion, but didn't end up disagreeing. "We don't know that for sure, Austin. We'll ride up to the tree line, but then we'll have to walk the horses through," she advised. He nodded, heading for the area where the girl had disappeared into the trees. He slid off Raven as soon as he got there, pulling the reins over the horse's head to use them as a lead even as he stepped into the trees, only to be met with a gun in his face. He put up both hands,
eyeing the kid with long black hair. He recognized him, he thought. He was a lot thinner, and his eyes were hollow, but it had to be the kid Savannah had been crushing on.
"Malachi?" Austin asked.
The kid blinked at him, and then pressed the gun forward another inch toward him.
"Who are you?"
the kid asked, his eyes wild as he looked behind Austin.
"I'm Savannah's father. This is my friend, Amanda," he said slowly. "How do I know that?"
the kid asked, the gun shaking in his hand.
"I'm Austin Merriman. Savannah left me a note in our trailer indicating that she was traveling with your family to my brother's place," he said evenly, fighting to remain calm when he knew his daughter was so close.
Malachi stared at him another moment before lowering the gun.
"I'm so sorry,"
he burst out, tears suddenly streaming down his pale cheeks. Several people emerged from the trees behind him before Austin could think of how to respond, including a frail woman who went to Malachi and wrapped an arm around his shoulders.
"You're sorry?" Austin repeated, his mouth suddenly very dry as he looked at the woman with dark hair the color of Malachi's.
The woman turned to look over her shoulder.
"Gretchen, get the note for Savannah's father," she whispered.
Austin looked from her to the boy.
"Where's Savannah?" he asked, his voice low.
Already he knew something was horribly wrong. If Savannah had been with them, she would have showed herself already. His stomach churned, and he literally felt weak in the knees.
"The man took her,"
he wailed. He could hear the sound of his own blood rushing in his ears as the world tilted a little. Amanda's hand on his arm helped ground him, and he swallowed the lump in his throat and dragged in a breath.
"The man took her." "What man? When? Where?" he asked, needing answers and wanting them right then.
The woman, Gretchen, rushed forward, handing Austin a piece of paper.
"If you want to see your daughter alive again, bring it to the David Tower in Denver. You know what I'm talking about. Don't wait too long."
Austin read the note several times.
"When did this happen?" he asked through gritted teeth, cursing Callum for dragging him into a seriously dangerous situation and inadvertently putting his daughter's life at risk.
"Last night," Malachi answered. "I woke up, I heard her scream, and I tried to follow, but he was on horseback. By the time I got our horse to chase them, they were already gone. I searched everywhere."
Austin closed his eyes, knowing he couldn't blame the boy. It was his own fault that his daughter was in danger. It had been his actions that had led to this.
"Austin, can I talk to you for a second?" Amanda asked, tugging on his arm.
He turned to face her. She used her head to gesture away from the small crowd of about 10 people. He followed, already having a pretty good idea what she wanted to talk to him about.
"What?" he snapped, going on the defensive.
"What is this 'it' the man is referring to?" she asked, her eyes staring into his.
He took a deep breath, knowing he owed her a real explanation. She'd been patient with him long enough and never pressed him about how he'd come to be in the water. It was time to confess.
"That night you found me, I was meeting someone. He handed me a USB drive, and a second later, a man on an ATV opened fire on us. He was killed. I dove over the side of the bridge to escape being shot, and the next thing I knew, you were pulling me out of the water," he explained. "I wanted to tell you before, Amanda, but, well, I wasn't sure it made sense. By the time I trusted you, I didn't want to inadvertently put your life in danger."
She crossed her arms over her chest. "Do you still have this USB drive?" He slowly nodded.
"I do."
"What's on it, Austin? And why did a man kidnap your daughter?"
He shrugged, staring her directly in the eyes.
I don't know. I haven't exactly had access to a computer. You're going to have to trust me on this. Callum wanted me to look into it and make the information public. We knew each other in college, and he knew I was a journalist who, at one time, had a reputation for exposing cover-ups and whistleblower territory. I had no idea that I or my daughter would be in danger when I went to meet him. She held his eye for another second, but then her expression softened, which he took for her giving him at least a modicum of trust. "Where is it?" she asked. He patted the front pocket of his jeans. "Here." She eyed it, and then asked pointedly, "How do you know it even survived the water?" "I don't. It was sealed inside a plastic case. When I checked at your house, it was dry as a bone." "This friend of yours, who was he exactly?" Austin took a deep breath and glanced back to Malachi and his group. "Look, I know you have a lot of questions, and I do too, but I don't have the time to stand around here playing 20 questions. I need to get to Denver and get my daughter back." "You can't go into war with a single sidearm," she protested with a raised voice. He turned to look back at the group then, knowing they'd have overheard her. Sure enough, all of them were watching them intently. He met Malachi's eyes and saw the real grief there before turning back to face Amanda. "I can't leave her there." "You said your brother's house was close. Let's go there first. We'll gather some guns and see if we can get him to come along. We need all the help we can get," she said. He swallowed, not wanting to tell her what he'd already decided. "You can't come," he stated. "I'm not letting you go alone," she shot back. "Amanda, I don't know what's on this drive, but if the man is willing to kidnap my daughter after trying to kill me once already and succeeded in killing my friend, I can't let you go with me. It's too dangerous. And I'm not letting you do this alone. You'll die. I did not save you and travel halfway across the country to let you go and die and leave me alone in the middle of nowhere," she hissed. He stared at her another moment and then turned to Mount Raven. "I need to get to my brother's," he growled. "Austin, wait. You can't leave me." "And what about them?" Amanda practically shouted. "I don't have time to wait around. I'm going now." She stood there staring at him in that way that told him she wasn't going to back down, her hand on Raven's harness to hold her still. The woman was stubborn and obstinate. He looked back toward the road, struggling with his own instincts. He was fond of Amanda, and he wanted her along. He just didn't want her hurt. At the same time, he owed her his life and couldn't abandon her with the revivalists. He owed her the promised land, or, in this case, Ennis's house. "Fine," he snapped. She smiled. "And them?" He dismounted and stalked back towards Malachi. "Did Savannah tell you where her uncle's house is?" "She didn't really have an exact address. She said she would know when she saw it." Austin groaned. She should have known, and doubted she ever would have found it, despite what she'd told the boy. "Do you have a pen, paper, pencil, anything?" he asked, not hiding his frustration. The woman who'd been standing next to Malachi nodded at Gretchen, and the woman ran back in the direction she'd gone before the woman in front of him extended her hand to Austin. "I'm Tanya Loveridge, Malachi's mother. It's nice to meet you. Thank you for taking care of my daughter this past month," he said, finally remembering his manners. For better or worse, these people had been there for his daughter when he'd been unable to take care of her. And the danger she was in now was his fault, not theirs. "Of course," she said with a wan smile. The same woman who had brought the note returned with a notebook and a pencil. There were only a few clean pages left in the spiral notebook, and he could see someone had been using it as a journal of sorts. He quickly sketched out a map that would lead them to Ennis's house,
promising them they could at least take a rest there and have a meal. He'd help them however he could, he assured them, after all they'd done for Savannah. He had a feeling his brother was going to kill him when he found out there was a whole group of people on their way, but he'd cross that bridge when he came to it. "This is the way to the house. If you leave now, you should be there by late this afternoon if you don't stop. I'm sorry, but I can't wait. I need to get there," he said, hoping they understood. "Of course. Please, go and save her. She's been a blessing to have along on this journey," Tanya said quietly. "We'll be praying for you." He looked at Malachi. "Thank you for keeping her safe," he said. Malachi nodded, not saying a word. He could see the fear and heartache in the kid's eyes, and knew the boy had feelings for his daughter. He'd deal with all that later, though, when he had her back safe and sound. Then he would ground her for life and forbid all contact with boys until she was 30. "Let's go," Austin said, turning back to Amanda and the horses. "It was nice to meet you all," Amanda said with a wave before heading away from the crowd. Back on the road, Austin gestured to Amanda to hurry. "We're not far," Austin said, kicking Raven into a trot. "Are you sure you want to travel on the road?" Amanda called out behind him, and then she was beside him, keeping pace on Charlie. "I'll shoot anyone who gets in my way," he replied. His brother's house was out of the way, but close. They'd stick to the roads, however. Austin needed them to help refamiliarize him with the area. The last thing he wanted was to find himself lost in the mountains while his daughter was locked up by a dangerous man. He knew the roads were treacherous, but he didn't have the luxury of going through the forest, not when there was a chance he could get turned around. He'd been serious when he'd said he would shoot anyone who got in his way. 32. Wendell didn't like the kid, and it was really that simple. He stood outside, leaned up against the side of the house, watching Nash and Ennis work to get the wind turbine running. The kid was cocky and thought he was smarter than everyone else. He wasn't. He knew a little bit about physics and whatnot, sure, but who really cared about any of that in this day and age? The jerk had invited himself to stay with his old friend, even though he didn't know Ennis like Wendell did. He had no right to crash at the house and eat Ennis's food and sleep in one of the beds. Not to mention the fact that he was buddying up to him, which was all the more clear as Wendell watched Ennis and Nash talk. He couldn't hear what they were saying, but he didn't like how chummy young Nash was getting with Ennis. The two men were doing something, though, pointing and gesturing, when Nash finally fist-bumped him. "It worked!" he exclaimed. Ennis slapped Nash on the back before throwing his arms around him and giving him a big hug. Wendell glared, his lip curling with disgust as he watched the exchange. Ennis turned to look at Wendell then, finally. "It worked! We'll have power tonight!" he shouted, jumping up and down. Wendell forced a smile. "Great!" The two of them came down the hillside, both of them laughing and chatting as they moved. Then they froze, looking up at Wendell just as he heard what they did. There was a loud commotion coming from the front of the house. Wendell moved away from the wall to see what it was, even as they hurried forward. "What is it?" Ennis called out, now jogging down the hillside. Wendell held up two fingers. "Two people on horseback," he called out. Nash was down the hill first, standing next to Wendell as they watched the people ride up the driveway. Ennis came up behind them, breathing hard. "Austin!" he called out, disbelief in his voice as he passed around the two of them. Wendell turned back to look at the bearded man and realized that, yeah, it was Austin. He smiled, thrilled to be with the Merriman brothers at the end of the world. He'd always known it would be like this one day. the three of them riding out the storm.
Ennis!
Austin shouted his brother's name, pulling the horse to a stop and sliding off. The two brothers embraced, and the woman who'd been riding alongside Austin dismounted and stood a few feet behind the brothers. Wendell couldn't hide his excitement as he stepped forward, ready to greet Austin with his own exuberant hug. When the two brothers separated, Wendell stepped up.
Austin, it's so good to see you!
And Austin looked at him with zero recognition, before turning to look back at his brother, completely dismissing him. Wendell felt like he'd been slapped.
This is Wendell from high school, Ennis said, making the introductions. Remember him? That's Nash back there, he said, gesturing for the kid to join them.
Austin looked at him and nodded, but clearly he didn't remember him at all. Talk about a jerk.
This is Amanda, Austin replied, his eyes back on his brother. Look, I know we have a lot to catch up on, but I'm here because I need help.
What's wrong? Ennis asked.
Savannah's been kidnapped. I need guns, Austin said flatly.
What the hell? Kidnapped? By who? Ennis asked.
It's a long story, and I need...
He stopped talking and looked directly at Wendell, and then Nash.
Can I have a minute? He asked in a lower voice.
Of course. Come in, and we'll get you guys some water.
Are you hungry?
Ennis asked, already moving to the front door.
We're fine. I need to talk to you now, Austin insisted.
Wendell stared at him, trying to figure out why the man would be ready to exclude an old friend.
Nash, he can understand. But him?
There was nothing to say about it, though, not when so much urgency was in the air, and Ennis was already ushering him toward the door.
Okay, sorry about the door, but you need to get on your hands and knees and crawl in. Be careful you don't hit the jack.
That's a long story as well, he muttered.
The group filed into the house one by one before the brothers headed into Ennis's room. Nash acted like he was king of the castle and got a glass of water for Amanda before offering her something to eat. Wendell stood against the wall, trying to hear what was happening in the other room. The bedroom door was partially closed, and he could hear the harsh voices talking back and forth, but he couldn't make out the words. Austin and Ennis came back into the main living area something like 5 minutes later. Wendell fetched himself his own glass of water, doing his best to appear cool and casual, as if he regularly hung out with the Merriman brothers.
"What's going on, guys?" Wendell asked.
Austin and Ennis exchanged a look.
"I need to go to Denver to get my daughter. Ennis is letting me use a few of his rifles," Austin said.
"Rifles? You have weapons?"
Wendell asked with surprise. He'd searched the house when Ennis and Nash had gone up to the mine. He'd only found a single handgun in a drawer in a nightstand. Austin was looking at him now, though, suspicion in his eyes.
He does.
What's in Denver?
Nash asked. My daughter, and the man who has her. I'm supposed to show up at David Tower to get her back, Austin said, a grim look on his face.
You're going to walk in there and ask for her back? Is that wise?
Wendell asked.
Austin shot him another glare.
It's my daughter. Do you think I'm going to leave her there?
No. I only meant that you're not going to go alone, are you?
Wendell corrected himself, recovering quickly. The fact was, he didn't think any daughter was quite worth a trip into the city to confront what he guessed to be armed men.
I'm going with him, Amanda chimed in.
Austin turned to look at her and gave her a small smile. Wendell cringed. Clearly there was something going on there. Leave it to the jock to hook up with a woman in the middle of an apocalypse.
I'm from that area. I'll go with you, Nash added immediately.
I can't ask you to do that, Austin said. You don't even know me. I'm up for it. If you give me a shooting lesson, I'm sure I can be a huge help. I know the area really well.
Thank you, Austin said, reaching out and shaking the kid's hand before slapping his other hand over it.
You know I'm not letting you take my AR anywhere without me, Ennis said with a laugh.
Thank you. You know how much I appreciate it. Your niece will be very happy to see you, Austin said, his eyes drifting to Wendell. Wendell thought fast. He was not the kind of guy who marched off to battle.
I guess that means I have to stay here and watch the house, he said, as if upset by that decision.
That's a good idea. Do you know how to shoot? He asked.
He won't be alone, Austin chimed in, before Wendell had a chance to answer.
What?
Ennis asked. Austin cleared his throat.
I need to give you a quick version of what else has been happening.
I was hurt and unable to get to Savannah. Amanda saved my life. While she was nursing me back to health, Savannah was taken in by a group of people. Preachers, revivalists, whatever. Anyway, Savannah was bringing them here to wait for me. And she almost made it. They're not far behind us. There's probably 10 of them. They took care of her, he said, looking at his brother and apparently communicating without words. Wendell watched them, more and more jealous of their close bond. He had always wanted to be a part of their group, but always found himself on the outside looking in. Now all of those old feelings were rushing back. So much for being glad that Austin had turned up. Ennis nodded.
We'll help him out.
Thank you, Austin said. Nash looked at Wendell.
Now you won't have to be alone.
Wendell pursed his lips, biting back the scathing reply he wanted to make.
Good.
My family has a small summer cabin on the South Platte River. It's isolated and shouldn't have been looted. Not much there beyond recreational stuff anyway. The point is, we have kayaks stored there. We can go in by water.
The tower isn't too far away from one of the small chutes off the river, Nash said.
Austin's eyes lit up.
Really? You know the city well enough to navigate it at night, on the river with no lights?
I do. I have a photographic memory. I can picture the tower in my head, along with the buildings around it. I've been there before.
We can come in on the kayaks, and we should be able to get to the building without him noticing.
If he's alone, that is. Do you know anything more about this guy?
I don't, but I'm going to assume he's working with a group, possibly even an army. And I know they're armed with semi-automatic rifles, if the man I met is anything to judge by.
Nash nodded, and Wendell could practically see the kid thinking. It made him sick. He hated people who thought they were smarter than everyone else.
I'm going to step outside and see if our guests are close, Wendell said.
He waited for a moment then, for someone to acknowledge he was leaving. But they were all talking about their strategy for going into the city. He wasn't wanted or needed. He crawled under the door and went into the trees, his anger bubbling to the surface after being held in for too long. He punched a tree, immediately sending pain through his hand. He felt his skin tear and looked down to see little droplets of blood running down his fingers. More annoyed than ever, he punched the tree again, another violent burst of pain exploding through his hand and up his arm in reaction.